to introduce our studio guest this morning. Due to the very positive response when he was last here, this person is making a return visit to continue our discussion on Islam. I'm referring, of course, to the Reverend Dr. Mark Durie, who is the vicar of the Church of Glenire Road that we have all driven past a million times. And I might also mention that Mark is a scholar on Islam. Good morning, Mark. Thanks for joining us again.
Great to be with you, Michael.
Mark, today I would like to open our discussion by looking at the subject of dhimmitude. And I believe this term refers to the status of non-Muslims living in Muslim lands. Is it true that the Jewish Egyptian-born writer and scholar of Islam, Bet Yol, was the one who coined the phrase? Can you elaborate this for us?
I believe it was first introduced by a French scholar, but a Lebanese scholar, but it was Bet Yol that really made it famous and established, defined its meaning. She herself was from a Dhimmi background in amongst the Jews in Egypt, and she began to explore the history of her own people, and that led her into the subject of the status of non-Muslim peoples under Islam in general.
Yeah, Mark, we're all watching with interest what's going on with ISIS in Iraq and Syria, and this militia has apparently declared a caliphate in the area they have conquered. And the news reported is that the Christians living in the Mosul area were given a choice of either converting to Islam, paying the tax, or facing death. Would you say this is a fairly typical example of how Dhimmis are likely to be treated as Islam marches around the world?
It's certainly true to the fundamental teachings of Islam. Muhammad said to his followers that they should offer the infidels three choices, which is to convert or the sword, or they surrender and live under Islamic rule. And this doctrine has been upheld by Muslim scholars in recent years from many different quarters. When Pope Benedict suggested that Islam had been spread by force, the Chief Justice of Saudi Arabia said, no, that's not true. They could always surrender and pay the tax. And so we have a very good example of how Islam's not spread by force in the Islamic State being formed in Syria and Iraq. So this is true to the teachings of Islam. It's true to the commentaries. It's true to the pattern of 1,400 years of rule. What's happening now in northern Iraq is how the Middle East was conquered. It is how Islam spread.
And this tax that we're talking about, this is a monetary tax?
Yes, it's a tax payable by adult males in exchange for their heads. The commentaries say that it's paid in order for them to keep their heads for another year to prevent future. The idea is this, probably goes back to Arab tribal warfare customs, that if you conquer your enemy, you own their life, and if you could kill them, you could take their wife and their children and possessions as your booty. So if you let them live, you've done them a favour, and you've denied yourself some compensation. So they then owe you a tax, and so they should reimburse you for the right to keep their head. And under classical Islamic law, non-Muslims living in an Islamic state had to buy their heads back each year by paying the jizya tax.
And is it mandated what this tax is? Is there a nominated figure?
The early jurists and scholars follow the example of the Companions of Muhammad, which is a certain amount of gold, so a smaller amount for poor people and more for richer people. The early documentation we have from the 8th, 9th, 10th century indicates that it was sometimes the equivalent of 30 or 40% of a labourer's wage for the year. What they've just translated, I think, these gold figures from the early textbooks into American dollars now. So they asked Christians in northern Iraq, and it's been happening in Syria for quite a while now. They asked them to pay, for example, $450, and one man couldn't pay, and so they said, "Oh, well, then your wife, your daughters are out." So they raped the women in front of the man. He committed suicide. Some families have converted to Islam in order to avoid the tax. Many have just fled, and as they've fled, everything has been taken from them except perhaps the clothes of their back, even if they're allowed to keep that. So they've just fled on foot.
And there's also a status issue, isn't there, with a Dhimmi?
Well, the Quran says fight the people of the book until they pay the jizya and are humbled and the word means to be made small. And that humbling is a legal process. It includes a lot of discrimination. So non-Muslims, their testimony is invalid in court against Muslims. They're not supposed to elevate themselves above Muslims. They can't display visible symbols of their religion. If you look at photographs of churches in Jerusalem in the 19th century, not a single church had a cross on it. And the whole raft of these discriminatory provisions is very extensive. Muhammad said that Jews and non-Muslims should, Muslims and non-Muslims should not look alike, so a discriminatory mark should be imposed upon them. So the yellow patch, you know, to mark off Jews and Christians was invented in medieval Islam, and now these radicals are putting the sign, the Arabic letter N for Nasrani, for Christian, on the doorposts of Christian homes. And it's interesting, among Christians around the world, they're adopting this Arabic letter N as a kind of sign of identity out of solidarity with the Christians in northern Iraq and in Syria.
Do you think that's where the Nazis adopted the patch for the Jews during the Holocaust?
That's an interesting question. It's a very similar strategy. Mm. It was well known. The connection between Islam's treatment of non-Muslims and Nazism is a fascinating issue. I think when Hitler went into Poland, he said, "Who remembers the genocide of the Armenians?" So it could well have been taken for there, but certainly it was a mainstream practice the very detailed discriminatory clothing requirements. In the first few centuries, Christians and Jews had to wear a lead seal around their neck to show that they'd paid the tax on their neck for a year, the neck seals. And they find these little seals in the archaeological digs and so on. But in later centuries, it was a special belt or, you know, different coloured shoes and things like that that were used to distinguish. These are the pre-modern times. So what happened was basically European powers invaded the Muslim world and they suppressed a lot of these discriminatory provisions, but never entirely. And we've forgotten just how difficult it was, and we've bought into a kind of romanticised view about coexistence of Islam with other faiths. But we're now seeing the realities of history being replayed.
Mm. Is it true that not only are significant Western Christian leaders embracing the Dhimmi syndrome, but the United Nations, in which Muslim nations form the most powerful voting bloc, have been a scene of much Dhimmification? One other thing, unfortunately, I think this epidemic is also creeping into our Jewish community. But that's another story.
You have to understand the psychology of the Dhimma is that non-Muslims are meant to be grateful and also to humble themselves, grateful for their lives, humble because of their inferior position. And certainly we've seen many kind of almost ritual statements of gratitude and self-humbling by Western leaders. Obama did this when he said how much the America owes to Islam and its history. And Christian leaders have also expressed gratitude and humility to Muslims in their outreach. Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland and head of the Human Rights Commission, gave an incredible speech saying how much the women almost owe their rights to Islam. And
So all that is a form of dhimmitude, that type of behaviour, I would call it behaviour.
Islam offers two statuses to non-Muslims. I mean classical, orthodox classical Islam. One is of belligerents and the other is of surrendered people. And what happens is that non-Muslims can easily adopt the psychology of the battered wife, the psychology of the surrendered person, where you're tending and befriend, the sense of threat. And as terrorism is increased and fear is increased, the tendency to conciliate, to appease, has become a very powerful psychological motif, I think, in Western responses to Islam.
Mm, it's quite sobering. In Australia, we have Hizb ut-Tahrir, which is an organisation that says that we should abandon our Western-style liberal democracy in favour of an Islamic rule. And presumably they would say that anybody choosing not to accept this concept would be a dhimmi. That could be a scary concept.
Yes. Look, many Muslims don't have radical views. They might just be wanting to get on with their lives. But a group like Hizb ut-Tahrir, they want to introduce the Islamic State. They uphold the principle of the dhimma. They want non-Muslims to pay the jizya tax. They know that eventually there will be warfare and they'll need to fight. But for the time being, they prefer to use peaceful means to prepare and to build up, you know, their situation. But yeah, they only offer that option. You should serve Islam or you should convert, or else, you know, these are this is the way it works.
You're listening to JR 87.8 FM. This is Nothing Left. My name's Michael Bird. My co-host is Alan Friedman, and our special guest in the studio is Dr. Mark Dury. Mark, at the start of 2007, Channel 4 in the UK screened a program titled Undercover Mosque, which presented video clips of Muslim preachers in Britain. The preachers' remarks incited hatred and violence against women, Jews, homosexuals and non-Muslims. However, the Telegraph, that's the UK Telegraph, reported the police and Crown Prosecutor, instead of investigating the Muslim preachers, investigated the television station. Isn't this a type of dhimmi attitude? Is this type of dhimmi attitude happening here in Australia too?
Yes, it is to an extent. I mean, this is a reflection of the idea of the guilt of the infidel. You know, this happens in Egypt where Copts are massacred, and as a result, the police arrest a few Christians. It was a very good example. I mean, fortunately, in the end, the station was able to get the police to withdraw and even, I think, pay compensation. But that idea that that Islam has to be protected, that Muslims, non-Muslims, are guilty, is an issue. Look, we've had this very difficult case here in Melbourne where two pastors were taken to the Islamic Council of Victoria for, taken to VCAT by the Islamic Council of Victoria for allegedly inciting hatred against Muslims, and their purpose was really to silence these people and stop them from speaking. And there was a knee-jerk reaction after the case began, where a number of leading clergymen of different faiths immediately sort of spoke out against what these pastors had been saying, I think without really investigating or understanding the complexities of the issue.
This was the catch the fire story?
That's right. That's right.
The buzzword these days is interfaith, when non-Muslim community leaders try to engage with Muslim community leaders. But when it comes to interfaith events in Australia, I find that most of the interaction is with, say, Turkish Islamic representatives, but this group has very little influence in the majority of Australia's Muslim community. Does your church have an interfaith program with the Muslim community, and if so, how do you find it?
We don't have an interfaith program with the Muslim community. That is our local parish. We're in Caulfield, you know. I'm very happy to have positive and good interactions with Muslim neighbours. The Anglican Church certainly has reached out in different ways to the Muslim community. The interfaith dialogues are important and need to be pursued, but we need to be realistic that often you get the very liberal people on either side speaking to each other, and fundamental issues don't really get addressed, and nothing changes as a result. So people place too much hope on these activities sometimes.
Yeah, Mark, you were telling us before we went on air that you've actually, there's a lot of Iranians that are coming to Australia and converting to Christianity. Would you like to give us a little bit of a background as to how that's happening?
Yes, the Iranian Revolution in 1979 has been in full swing, really, since that time. And one of the effects of that is that many Iranians have become very unhappy about Islam and dislike it intensely. And those that manage to leave the country and come to Australia, a very high proportion of them want to leave Islam. And there is this incredible movement of Iranians to embrace other religions, particularly Christianity. It's estimated that hundreds of thousands of Iranians have become Christians, perhaps even as much as a million since the Iranian Revolution. And I'm involved in pastoring a church of more than 100 Iranians who were all Muslims a couple of years ago.
And this is all happening in Caulfield.
Well, I'm based in Caulfield, but they come from all over Melbourne. Our main meeting's in Dandenong, and we baptised 21 on Sunday.
And do these people end up all in the same stream of Christianity, or could it just vary depending on where they're living and what's happening in their local area?
It depends on where they live. Many of them just in ones and twos in churches all over Melbourne, all over Australia, really. But sometimes they gather in groups if they can't speak English as much as well. That's important for them. So they'll be in Pentecostal churches, Catholic churches, Anglican churches. It's all over the place.
And do they, I imagine they would need a lot of education about Christianity, or do they have a bit of an idea of what's involved?
No, they need a lot of teaching, and they're very happy to receive that. So there's a lot of training, and they bring some assumptions about faith over from Islam that are not true to what Christian faith teaches. So that's a very interesting process to work through with them.
Mm. Are there ministers? Do they have their own ministers?
Well, when you have so many people coming to a religion in a short time, you have to really raise up ministers from among them. Mm. So we work with translators and so raising up leaders. So these 20 people who were baptized, they were all trained and taught by other Iranian Christians who we trained to teach others. So we're building up a system where they can help each other.
And would they then possibly be at risk from their Muslim cousins?
There's a risk in Australia, but the biggest risk is to their families and friends back in Iran.
Yeah.
And that's already an issue for some of them. And that's very serious. And for some, it can cause a great deal of grief. Yeah, it's serious. When they make a decision to leave Islam, become a Christian, it actually could put their whole family at risk back in Iran. So it's not a light decision that they make. Not an easy decision.
Yeah, Mark. Most of us know the Lebanese community in Lakemba, although I doubt if any of our listeners have ever been there. But it seems as if most of the extremist views emanate from that part of Sydney. Is this correct? And if not, do we have any idea where the majority of extremist views in the Muslim community are coming from?
Look, I think they're all over Australia. There is a group of radicals. There's been a very active group in Melbourne over the years. One of the things I did after 9/11 was to document some of the websites of some groups in the northern part of Melbourne. The ideology behind this has been part of a global movement of revivalist Islam that promises supremacy and dominance if only Muslims return to their orthodox faith, to their conservative roots, and that hope of a great and glorious day when Islam will be dominant again in the world has inspired a trend towards more radical beliefs and behaviours. And you'll find that everywhere in the world where there are Muslim communities.
Mm. And, well, it seems to be working, or is it? Is there an increase in radicalised Muslims in this country?
Oh, I think that's definitely the case. There has been an upswing in more conservative views amongst Muslims for decades, not just here but everywhere. So if you looked at a graduating photograph of people coming out of university in Egypt in the 1970s, most of the women would not have been veiled. Today they mainly are veiled. And the same would be the case in Malaysia, Indonesia, all over the Muslim world. And it is working and it's not working. So it's working in the sense that this movement has been gaining steam for 100 years and is now very strong. The organisation of the Islamic Conference is a reflection of that movement. But it's not working in the sense that the people that have lived for a sustained period of time in regimes where the revolution has happened, such as Iran, many of them are turning away from Islam. And so there's probably never been a time in history when so many Muslims have been wanting to leave Islam as today. And I think one of the likely effects of the advance of radical Islam in Iraq, in Syria, will be a deep disenchantment and a turning away. So I hear reports from Egypt, Nigeria, even from the refugee camps in Syria, that they are seeing unprecedented numbers of Muslims who really want to leave Islam. So I think the effect of the Islam promises success, the call to prayer has come to success. And the great theological question for Muslims is, why are we not the rulers of the world? Mm. And the answer to that was, if only we're more faithful, then we will be the rulers. But then if you implement the solution and then the solution fails, that sort of suggests to you that the religion is the problem and not the solution. And then you have the backlash, so the rejection of the Muslim Brotherhood, for example, in Egypt. And I think you're going to see more and more, though this will cause a deep confusion in the Muslim world. So they can place their hope in Islam as the sort of source, as a solution to life's problems. But when that solution is no longer the solution, you'll see despair, people turning to other belief systems, people trying to find another way through. So we're in a very confused and fascinating, disruptive time for Muslims in their, and their place in the world.
Mm. I think the trouble is that with Islam, they mix politics and Islam, unlike most other religions. With them, there's this no dividing line, and that's why you've got the Muslim Brotherhood, say, in Qatar, which is the home of Al Jazeera, supporting Hamas, and you've got Egypt rejecting it. It's a lot of politics, and I think more politics and less religion. Mark, what about all the Christians that are disappearing from the Middle East? Like, for instance, Lebanon, years ago, was that predominantly, from what I believe, Christian country. Now the Christians in Lebanon are a minority. The Christians in even in the Palestinian territories and in Iraq, they're all, some people say they're being ethnically cleansed. What's happening to the Christians in the Middle East? They seem to be reducing.
If they can, they're fleeing. In Iraq, there were 1.5 million Christians in 2000. There's perhaps a couple of 100,000 left today. Mosul has been a major Christian city for all the time that Islam's been there, and now there's not a Christian left. And so they're fleeing. They're battered. They're beaten. They've lost everything. They're highly traumatized. It's just an incredible bitter grief to my heart that Christians in the West seem so indifferent to their fate. Why don't we have tens of thousands of Christians protesting in the streets over the far greater sufferings that the Christians are going through in the Middle East than, for example, what's happening in Gaza is just very small compared to the horrors of northern Iraq. And that's a great grief. Really, Australia and other countries that are able to should, I think, be reaching out to these Christians and providing a home for them. They'll be great citizens of this country, and they need a lot more. They need comfort as well. I read heart-rending a complaint from one of the bishops in Mosul saying, why are the Christians of the world so indifferent to us? It's almost a greater pain as the hatred they experience from the radical Muslims that their brothers and sisters, so our faith tells them we are, in the West are so silent in this time of their terrible horror, really.
Where would they be going? Because most of the neighbouring countries are also Islamic. Are they a little more tolerant than say, where ISIS is set up?
The Kurds are protecting them. So the Kurds have set up a nationalist state that's gradually emerging. While they're Islamic, then their identity is Kurdish primarily rather than Islamic.
Mm.
And they have been sending fighters in to protect Christian towns and they're offering protection. So the international community can help them there. Many Christians have fled into Jordan. Jordan is full of refugees, and so also are areas in Syria controlled by the government. They are full of refugees as well. So there are places that they're fleeing to, and they can be helped. We need to do that. It's really important.
Mm. Mark, we need to finish the segment now, but I would like to thank you again for joining us this morning. I feel there is still more material we could cover, but we will have to save that for another time. This is Nothing Left, and when we return after this short musical break, when we'll take a closer look at the current state of affairs in Israel and Gaza and hear from Israeli journalist Yossi Klein Halevi. You are welcome to join in the conversation by ringing us on 9534 8334. And I would just like to, Ellen, I would like to thank you very much, Mark, for coming in and spending the time with us. And it's been most informative.
Yes. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for coming in. Our guest has been Reverend Dr. Mark Durie from the Glenira Church that we all know. And we might have a regular place here for you, Mark. So we'll have to get you back and continue the discussion. So thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Alan. It's been great to be with you.
Thanks. Good morning.